you've landed inside Launch Street, the Business Innovation Podcast, where we interview top innovators out there shaking things up so you can innovate, differentiate, and get further faster. Since you're here, we know you're the type of person that recognizes the importance of unlocking your innovation advantage so you can compete and win. And now, your host, the person that has worked with leading companies like Disney, Procter & Gamble, Arrow Electronics, the U.S. Army Research Labs, and Red Robin on upping their innovation advantage, Tamara Gontor.
Hello, hello, Tamara here. I hope your day is going as well as mine. I feel like it's one of those days where I am winning the day. Do you know what I mean? Oh, it feels so good. All right, speaking of winning, today's podcast guest, Carol Sanford, is about winning, but in a different way. And in fact, I'd say that she's winning because she really is one of those incredible lifelong learners that's always kind of growing and adapting and learning along the way and then sharing that with other people. And what I think is most interesting in her work is A, her rejection of best practices and how they create a toxic culture, not a winning one. So we got to be careful what best practices we put into play. And B, her approach to living what she calls a regenerative life, a life where you are always learning and growing and innovating. It's this idea that there are 9 different regenerative roles we play. And depending on the different situation, different roles are more appropriate. So she kind of rejects this idea that we're all this or labeling us as this versus that. She's saying, no, it's not about that. It's about applying the right kind of learning and growth mindset to the right role. And there's actually 9 of them. I think the other thing that I found interesting about our conversation, I think you will too, is this kind of concept that she talks about not listening to outside experts and listening to your inner expert. And as she says, we underestimate our own ability to figure things out. We talk about how to get over that in this podcast. The work that she does has all been put together in her upcoming book, The Regenerative Life, Transform Any Organization, Our Society, and Your Destiny. And it's the focus of our conversation today. So a couple quick and important announcements before we dive into the interview. Because of my book launch on May 5th, so Innovation is Everybody's Business, we have a lot of bonuses and bundles happening in our community. So if you aren't already, be sure that you're in our community, that you've joined us so we can send you these incredible bonuses that are for our everyday innovators only. And, you know, make sure you sign up for our newsletter. And actually, I hate to call it a newsletter because it really is where we share access to the podcast, but also incredible tips and ideas and stories that will help you up your innovation game and win. So make sure you join us so we can get you access to this stuff, because this is, I don't know if it's a one-time event, but really we put this all together because of the book. So the second thing is, do your fellow everyday innovators a solid and leave our podcast a 5-star review and a comment about what you get out of it. It'll only take you a minute, but that minute will lead to more listeners. And the more listeners we get, the more value we get to provide the world. And we continue to get great guests because they know we're in a powerful community. So I kind of consider that a win-win-win-win. So there's that winning theme again. All right, on to the interview with Carol. Carol, thank you so much for joining me today. I'm very much looking forward to the conversation.
Well, I am too, Tamara. Thanks for inviting me.
So what's the one thing people would be surprised to learn about you?
So I raised 4 teenagers I did not give birth to. I did not adopt them. My son brought them home because they were in struggles in their own family all about the age of 14. So he brought home lost children, not lost dogs and cats. One of them, I paid for her wedding. I paid for her college. Her children call me grandma. And so I love kids, and especially ones who, when they hit teenage years, need something more. And I'm really good with teenagers, not so good when they're really, really young.
Well, maybe I need to get some advice from you, because I have a 15-year-old and 11-year-old, both boys. But let me just back up for a second and say thank you for doing the work that you do with kids. There's so many. I do a lot of work with at-risk and underserved youth here in Colorado. And there are so many, to your point, particularly at that age, where things really hit the fan for them, where they just need to find a supportive place and person that can push them forward.
Yeah, I agree. And I don't touch that anymore. Those kids are all pretty grown up and have their own kids, but it's something I still treasure. So when you had that question, I thought, oh, I'm going to relive that by talking about it for a second.
No, it's wonderful. I mean, I think it's just, and it must be so rewarding on your end too, to your point, have these kids call you grandma and just know that those people are out in the world doing their thing.
Yep, it is.
So that's awesome. So I am excited to kind of dig into your area of expertise. I wanted to actually start with a higher level question to really set the stage for the rest of it. And that question is, from your perspective, what is wrong with our society's current idea of who can change the world?
Now, you're going to be really startled, given what you just called me, an expert. The biggest problem we have is we think there are experts.
Yeah.
And what is missing is the idea that we can come to our own understanding through our own experience if we're engaged in an educated process. So I think we have moved way too much toward experts where we borrow their ideas, we borrow them untested, and then it creates a lot of copycatting and people not thinking for themselves. My work is about I'm an educator. I'm not a consultant. I'm not a coach. I'm not a mentor. I'm an educator to build the mind that can play the kind of roles and carry out the kind of work that they want to do in the world, but from their own well-tested, well-discovered ideas.
You know, it's interesting to hear you say that about the expert. I'm kind of smiling a little bit. I really like that positioning of it. And I'll tell you from our perspective, the work that we do in innovation around what we call it human-centered innovation. And what we really mean by that is that everybody not only can innovate, but is responsible for innovation. And one of the things that I think you said as you were kind of gearing that up was that, you know, we rely on other people. And I think in looking to the experts and the innovators and the creatives, and I have my air quotes up as I'm saying this, but right. In looking to those people, we are really minimizing and decreasing our own skills, don't you think, even though we have them?
Well, of course. And we societally have a lot of things going on, staying with your early question, which get in our way, which is we are given feedback from other people so much we come to trust it and not our own reflection. That capacity doesn't get built. It leaves us with people looking sideways all the time or behind them to see what other people are saying. And we don't build that consciousness and capacity and courage to really check in with ourselves. And then, of course, we don't build work systems that support that.
Why do you think we do that? Is that us being lazy, or is that just, you know, years of, you know, of just being told that, hey, that's the expert, that's the innovator, not you?
So I'm going to tell you exactly when it started. It started in the 1920s when a man named John Watson, who was at Johns Hopkins University, created something called behavioral psychology. Well, that's what we call it now. It was the idea of incentives, rewards, recognition, and he believed that people couldn't see themselves. And the reason was because he couldn't study that. He only wanted to be able to study that which he could see visually, because that was the scientific paradigm. And so instead of ever asking people what they thought and what they could see, he only did stuff that he could watch from the outside and create an interpretation. Mm-hmm. Behavioral psychology has become the predominant paradigm in everything from parenting to education to business. And it is not true. It is a lie. It is a myth that has been foisted on us. And it's so pervasive and so familiar that we can't imagine it could not be true. So I write books repeatedly to show how that, and I did work in psychology, so I did all my dissertation work on confronting that kind of theory. It is so pervasive that it undermines everything, including what we're talking about right now. I don't believe I can see me. I believe only you can see me. I have to have your feedback, my boss's feedback, my parents. And then as parents, what we do is say, good boy, good girl, this is what you did. We give people gold stars, and then we give them bonuses. All of that is undermining this core capacity to have a society that works and human beings that have their lives at work. And as you say, being able to put that to good work on innovative practice.
It's so, as you were talking, I was just kind of taking a deep breath. You probably heard it because I have too sensitive microphone. But the reason it made me kind of pause and take a deep breath is it makes me realize how undervaluing of ourselves that we do by doing that too. I mean, it really kind of chips away at our own self-esteem and our own belief in what's possible, doesn't it? Because we're expecting somebody else to tell us.
Well, and especially we undervalue our ability to figure things out, to think, to create, to have our own mind be able to make sense of something because of the expert model, the external model, let me just give you a quick example. When I did my doctoral work, I pulled together, you couldn't do this now, I'm old, so it hadn't been removed from the practice yet. I took 9 boys on each side of an equation, and they were reported to be pretty consistent liars. They had trouble knowing what the truth was. I did a really quick piece of work. Well, I didn't do it. I had proctors in the room because we were keeping it all, you know, according to the regulations. I asked the first group to do a set of exercises. If you can image, I just had them moving their arms being flat at their side up to the top over their head. And they had to do that on a count of 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. And their hands had to be in a specific place. I then, at the end, for that first 9 boys, I said, well, how did you do? Were you right on the mark? And they all said, yes. What they didn't know is we had been video recording them. And I said, would you like to see the video? And they were all a little startled. We showed them the video. I said, well, what do you think? And they said, the video is wrong. We were perfect. I said, oh, okay. I didn't expect that result. But we did it again. We did it a third time. And by then, they would not respond to how they were doing. I took a second group of 9 boys, same conditions, and I said, do the exercise. How did you do? They all said, perfect. And I said, if you were going to do better next time, it be more precise, what would you do? They were all a little bit startled. Why in the world would we have to figure out how to do it better next time? But they came up with a couple of ideas. One was, they said, well, let's get in a circle so we can see each other. Okay, get in a circle. So they did that, and definitely they were better. And then I said, all right, if you were going to do better next time, what would you do? They said, oh, we're in a studio here with a mirror on this wall. Let's look at the mirror. Great, let's do that. And then the third time I asked them, what would you do to be better? They said, make it harder. Let's count to 10. Now, we went back and redid the same exercise with the first 9, and believe it or not, they all got unstuck. The minute you asked them what they thought, they were still young, they were able to come, they had different ideas about what they would do, but the lesson was, when we are constantly given back something from the outside world, we increasingly, as you said, don't trust ourselves. On the other hand, if we're assumed to be trusted, and we're allowed to not be within rigid confines, we will make it more challenging. We will take on more complexity, and be, which, of course, as you know, is profoundly important if you're trying to innovate. You have to be able to handle complexity and change and dynamics, and you have to be able to invent out of nothing. That started me, and I was, you know, I was young. I was still in my late 20s when I was doing that. It profoundly changed my view of the world and the direction I've worked on for the last 50 since then. Help people be in charge of their own thinking. I've added to it then, learning how to educate people to use their mind to do that. But I think that story is so clear.
Yeah. And, you know, I just wrote down, be in charge of your own thinking. One of the things, Carol, I'm really, really appreciating, I want all of us on Launch Street to really pay attention to, I think, Carol's, not just your passion for the subject, which is fantastic, but also it comes from the place of recognition that I think that we as humans want to creative problem solve. We want to do our best, like in general, right? That's a great perspective to come from about the people, about ourselves and the people around us. And I think oftentimes, in leadership, we tend to come from the place of that person doesn't want to do their best. That person doesn't want to contribute their most. But I have, without a doubt, found the opposite to be true. And I think that story you just told really brings that to life.
Let me add one thing to that, because I definitely agree with you. We get in boxes, we put people in boxes, and we have tests that can score them and put them in boxes. The other thing that I believe is because of those boxes we put people in, we get generic categories, and we're judging everybody by what they all look like. We often call them core competencies. So we aren't even seeing a person.
Right.
We're seeing a behavior that is lacking or carried out, and so we create judgment about them. The way I think we have to shift that, and what's really important and what I, you know, focus on, is learning to see essence in each being. And that's not strengths. It is not a set of things that are in the outside world. It is core to how they work inside. So if you'll let me, I'll give you an example of me.
Yeah.
I got in trouble all the time when I was a kid because I, and not just when I was 2 years old, I questioned everything. It's how I was able to see what John Watson and then B.F. Skinner were doing to us. I don't read anything and accept it as face value. I test it. And my one of the three aspects of my essence quality is I really always seek to disrupt certainty, first in myself and then in others. Now, that's not a doing. It's not something about a strength. It is something that was born with me. And the memoir I'm working on right now is going to talk about how that's my version of smart. I know very few people, and nature doesn't duplicate, and so here I am, this unique being. If I can come to understand what that essence quality is in me, and we have organizations which are designed to have people to have more personal agency, more initiative in the context of a larger strategy, that would profoundly change everything you and I are talking about right now. Because we would have no boxes, no topologies, no tests people took that figured out how they fit what the ideal was. There would be no ideal. There might be in strategy terms, but not in individual terms. What will you do when you awaken that essence quality? And I design work systems which can do that, but I also do it with the leaders when I first go in. And I look at their history, the core things that you begin to see, the patterns. And out of that, we're able to extract this. And if it helps, I can give you an example of a company that you can do that with. Okay, you want that. All right. Yeah. All right, let me take one of my favorite ones. I was just on a call with Jeffrey Hollander, who is the founder and founding CEO of Seventh Generation, non-toxic paper products, household products, baby products. When I first met Jeffrey, and this is something I do at the beginning of every engagement, I asked them to give me a certain set of information, and I'm not going to try and teach how to do that because it's much more complex, but I just do it for people at the beginning. And what we discovered in looking at the patterns of choices he had made and how he had risen above challenges in life. And again, I'm not looking for strengths. I want to make that very, very clear because this is a very different thing, because strengths are something we gain from being in a social system where we learn things and we get stronger and stronger at them. And I can tell you how many things I have strengths in that are not compatible very much with my essence. And for a long time, I kept trying to use them because people say you're good at that. But once with Jeffrey, what we discovered was that Jeffrey really loves refusing to accept what people say if they consistently perform differently. He joined several groups that were beginning to question businesses and how they were working. They were saying it was the greenwashing era, well, which we're still in, by the way. But he would question them. So he had this company, Seventh Generation. It is up against P&G, you know, all the big companies that are working in personal care and household products. They were being sold through Walmart. He decided that he would not sell to Walmart until they would have a conversation with him about why they were selling products which were not good for health. And at this point, Lee Scott, who was the CEO, was starting to question climate change and what he needed to do and his company to do. When Jeffrey went in, what he did is have a conversation with him about integrity in your word. And Jeffrey is so determined to have integrity in his word that we were able to articulate that as essence. Now, what we use that is to innovate like crazy in the marketplace, because once you get to essence, you can use that to create, to innovate, because nobody else can be you. We created, I say we, I didn't do a thing except be the educator for the 5 years we were working on this. But let me say we, because it feels like it's mine and I own stock in them at the time. we built a relationship with Babies R Us and started innovating products that were always marketed, always designed, always engaged, from having everything be so transparent that they wrote the very first ever, social responsibility or corporate responsibility reports, right, and even talked about all the things they were doing that did not meet their own criteria. And every time anything went wrong, they did a press release on it because they wanted people to understand how important it is to say what you mean and do what you say and have that kind of integrity. It created a whole new line of products for Babies R Us, which, of course, doesn't exist as of last year. But in the meantime, what it did is create a brand which grew 35 to 65% in revenue a year, all because we were in integrity with the essence of the founding. I've done that with DuPont also. We won't go back to that one, but all the way back to E.I. DuPont and the American Revolution. And rebuilt DuPont, shifted, sold off businesses, brought in new products, and did that with Chad Holliday, who is the CEO. That process allowed him to make clear, distinct, innovative decisions, and for everyone else in the organization to do so, because we weren't figuring out what the competitors are doing. We were not asking customers what they wanted. We were innovating out of the essence of DuPont and Seventh Generation, and now many other companies I work with. Is this making any sense?
Well, if it wasn't, I would have stopped you.
Okay,
so,
good.
Yeah. So, well, there's a couple things I was just writing down that I just want to take a moment to pause before I ask my next question, just for all of us on Launch Street to really consider. You know, one thing is, so first of all, to your kind of, you've used the word uniqueness a lot. And I think what's cool about us as humans, and really, well, I guess, most species, but for us to focus the conversation, you know, that we are a brain wiring, no two wiring is the same, which means that our brain is as unique as our thumbprint. And yeah. I think that's pretty cool because to your point about kind of uniqueness and kind of trusting our own North Star and recognizing what we bring to the table. And I think at the organizational level, you know, we always talk about innovation, and this is one of the myths that drive me nuts, of this, like, you've got to throw away your box and, you know, go out into the blue skies where nothing has ever been done. It's all white space. But to your point about kind of who you are and your essence and your uniqueness, that is the best place to start with innovation, not to throw all that stuff away. I don't know why people do that. It drives me crazy. There's so much innovation right in front of you if you figure out with a little clarity who you are first. So I think it's one of those other myths out there. I want to ask you a question of something that came from your book. So the book is The Regenerative Life, Transform Any Organization, Our Society, and Your Destiny. So you talk about how, and you kind of hinted at this a little bit as we were talking about putting people in boxes, but you talk about how people can grow and develop beyond what their leaders or anyone else sees possible. So first is, like I said, we started down this path, but I want to come back to it. Why is it so hard for us to see the possibilities in others?
Again, it's the lack of education. We've been conditioned in behavioral psychology, and we think we actually can see them correctly. We have this illusion that what we're seeing is true. Psychology today did some really interesting research on feedback, and that was my last book, No More Feedback. And what they found was that about 85 to 87% of what people were telling others actually belonged to the person who was
projecting.
They were projecting. And that was startling, even to the people who in the research project discovered, and the way they did it is had you write out what you saw in other people and change to put your own name in and then ask how much it fit you. And people could see it when they were able to do it for themselves. Mm. So I think projection is a huge part. Plus, I think we don't know how to be resources to people in their own self-discovery. We think we have to be the rescuer, especially when we're in leadership roles, we're in parenting roles, we're in, you know, educator, top of the class roles. We think that we have to know and that we won't look smart. So there's our own projection problem, but there's also our own quieting. And if there's anything I like for people to let go of when they're going to do this kind of work as you're talking about, not throw out, but put the side, is noticing their own tendencies and how it is they've been working and move away from those mental models into what we call living systems frameworks, which really means being willing to look at it in a different way and to construct one. And it sounds like what you're trying to do also. So I think we get in trouble because we don't understand ourselves and we don't even understand how much we project onto other people.
Yeah, you know, I think it's fascinating. I think what we've seen in our work too, just to add to layer to that is, you know, as leaders, not only, and I love that research and the feedback because it's, I feel like most of the time, like when somebody's upset with me, they're really upset with themselves and they just like they're taking it out on me, whether that's personal, professional, it seems to tend to be more about them than it is the person they're talking to. But I think the other layer to that is when it comes to how we work or our leadership style or how we want innovation to happen, the behaviors and the types of innovation we expect. Unfortunately, we're very, actually can be very myopic about it. So we think that it should happen in the way that we know. And I don't think we're malicious about it. I think it's this lack of understanding around, there's a lot of different cognitive approaches to your point about beyond the surface, right? Going a little bit deeper. But you know, so I innovate in a certain way. So I expect you, Carol, to do it that way. And when you don't do it that way, instead of leveraging that diversity, I then get frustrated because you're not doing it in a way that I understand or I can see, to your point about like what I can kind of measure. I can measure what I know, but I can't measure your way of doing it because I don't understand that.
Yeah, I really agree. And the thing that I like your term layering, what I would, you know, add is an additional kind of surrounding it is we are not given the education and engagement process to teach us to reflect. Mm-hmm. We are usually taught to know and to work with knowledge. And that is, I think, a huge missing piece in order for us to see others or even see ourselves. We can't see the mental process as it goes in our own mind. And so it doesn't occur to us somebody else might have a different mental process, might have a different, that results in a different way of doing. My core and why I keep saying I'm an educator is we introduce frameworks that allow people to do self-assessment, not other assessment, but self-assessment. And sometimes that self is the team as a whole, but all of that is in preparation for being able to become much more strategic, more innovative, more direct with the specific markets we need to be connecting to, different kinds of leaders. Without that capacity for reflection, which John Watson told us didn't exist, so he never studied it because he didn't believe it existed, and then set in motion, and I, in my last book, talk about how we got the behavioral theory over into psychology because it came from machines. Of course, they're on automatic, they're mechanical. But without that capacity to reflect, I don't believe we can do what you just talked about or what I talk about.
Yeah, no, I think it's really important to understand that about ourselves. I was fortunate enough to get a sneak peek into your book because we have the same publisher, so I was allowed. I'm a trusted source since we both come from the same place. And one of the things that it talks about in there is there are 9 regenerative roles. Will you talk a little bit about those roles or actually I'll let you decide, does it make sense to talk about all 9 or maybe focus on 1 or 2 that you can dig into?
I think maybe giving people a picture of the whole might help.
Okay.
And I'll do one little example. My grandfather taught me about roles. He half Mohawk, and my grandmother also was part Mohawk. And they work with archetypal images. Now, you have to remember that we are not one of these roles. We are not an archetype. And in our culture, the behavioralist created an idea that we all are something. So you can take a test and find out what you are. No, you are your essence. But as I worked with my grandfather, he taught me to be able to see when I needed to take on a different role. And I would watch him do it. It's a little like when people ask, well, what would Aristotle do here? Or what would my father do? Or what would Jesus do? Depending on what you consider the role that would be appropriate you feel like you're in, and it lifts you up. But my question was not at the level of individual, but how do we make societies work? It will work also for individuals, but I begin to see, and I had worked with this universal symbol called the Enneagram, and I had seen it misused and put into
psychology,
and everybody
I've taken that.
Oh, that drives me crazy because that is not what that symbol's about. It's about transformation of a whole individual, a whole society. And as I played with it, I found what I think are nine core roles that for society to transform itself, these have to move to a different level of thinking. And we aren't any one of them at any one time, but we may be all of them over our lifetime. So I then saw that there were three sets of three within this nine. The first set were the initiators. If we want society to really work, we have to have people who get people off the ground and get projects, get work off the ground, and build a capacity that needs to be there. And I found there were three of those. The first is parent. And you don't have to give birth to a child to need to be in a parenting role. As I, one of the reasons I use my opening story is my kids were, you know, teenagers too, but I had to step into a different kind of parent. I had to really put on the mantle, the cloak of thinking about parenting. If you're an aunt, an uncle, a grandmother, I'm back there doing it with my grandchildren. The second of those initiator roles is the designer. The designer is helping figure out how something needs to work. What does it need to look like? And that can be everything from a software program to a piece of beautiful pottery and or a project you're running or a program you're going to lead. That foundational design work is critical to so many things, and often people don't bother to design live and new. They right. copy and borrow things and don't wake up. The third of those roles, which I feel are initiators, I call earth tenders. If we don't understand the planet we live on, how it is a nest which we live in and we are nested in it, and we're able to engage in a way that keeps it vital and viable, then we're all in trouble. So those three core roles I looked at, and by the way, this was an action learning project. I had 100 people who came and studied and worked with me for 6 months to go test differently how they were doing a role. And the people who did designer reported back to me that if some of them were owners of companies, others were leader of processes like at Omega Institute. And it changed completely how when they were in that role, they did it. So it was a powerful way to explore. All right. First set is initiators. Second set are manifestors. All right. So somebody gets the conditions right, gets things working, the mind working right, but somebody else needs to go out and manifest in the world, make things happen. And I found three of those. The one which probably none of your listeners will be surprised is entrepreneur. And you don't have to own a small business to be entrepreneurial. That's core right. to innovation anywhere, right? And so I had people innovating campaigns, how they did political campaigns, as well as their businesses. The second role is citizen, because if we can't, and you know, right now we're in election season here in the States, and we have to step up and be a citizen again. We have to ask ourselves, rather than a ballot shows up, we ask who to vote and how do we vote. That's not being a citizen. The third of those manifestor roles is the economic shaper. How do we construct the way we manage and think about money and economy really means household. How do we have healthy households, including the household of the planet? So I had people from all three of those roles who were doing amazing thing in their society and social system. By the way, these were around the world. I had people in Europe, South America, Australia, one out of Africa, because I've worked there quite a bit. Our third set of roles are what I call the destabilizers or the disruptors. Because if you want to transform a society, you can't just work with trying to keep everything in homeostasis, which we all love. You know, please don't upset my, you know, my apple cart. But we need that. And one of those roles, and I had several, everything from college professors to elementary school, were in the first of the destabilizer roles, is the educator. Now, unfortunately, what the educators have become are people who try and stabilize. They try and get everybody to know the same thing, to know it by all taking the test and somebody else deciding whether you pass. The second of the destabilizer roles is the content media creator. We have so much comes at us, and the idea of a media creator when they're working regeneratively is to help us see clearly what is true. We all know how much we struggle right now with knowing whether the truth is coming through the media we get. And that can be everything from what you and I do with podcasts or writing books or doing documentaries, or the woman, one of the women who wrote the foreword to my book, is the host for NPR on Here and Now. She did join the process as well as wrote the foreword. And she said, this idea of out of every time in my journalist role, because she's also a parent, but every time in my journalist, media content creator, if I can remember the value I'm supposed to leave there is hope. That is right. Really why we need the journalist. It's to see something can be transformed. One more, the final of the nine and of the three destabilizers is spirit resource. How do we work with people that helps lift up their spirit, help them learn to be in charge of themselves, make their own decisions? Resource means to return people to themselves as the source. So imagine 100 people working with me and going out in the world and trying each of these using the set of guidelines I give them in a book. So there's a quick and dirty 7-minute overview of the nine that is a 3x3 process.
So I love the how you broke it down. Help me understand, if I'm listening, am I one of these roles? Am I a combination? Am I different at different times? Do I have a certain thing that I gravitate towards? Like,
nope.
You know,
nope.
Okay.
Nope. All of that came out of people misusing the Enneagram. You are not any of these roles. You are your essence. And once you know what that is, you stand in that. You stand so clear in it. You say, now, what is needed now? So think about if you're off in an office all day and you're walking in the door coming home, and where you've been is an entrepreneur all day, but you're walking in and you say, what is needed now? And it could be if you have children, then you know what is needed now really is a parenting role. And you literally choose. These are like archetypes in the form of what I'm calling roles. And you are choosing what's needed and then using that to kind of brace yourself and lift yourself up. Imagine you're putting it on as a cloak, except in this book I talk about the non-heroic approach, because you do this in everyday life. Over my life, I think I have done every one of these and come back to many of them. And once I knew what they were, I became more intentional. I run a lot of long-term communities, which one of them is based on building the capacity to be a spirit resource. And that is working wherever your company, or whether you're working with parents or what you're doing, to learn to help people be able to see their inner work and lift themselves up. So when I am doing that, I am, and right now you and I are in the media content creator role. I say, what is needed? You're listening to your listeners. What are they asking? Making sure you get that from me. You are in that archetype. But when you leave this particular thing, you go back and you have children. So you go into parenting role. And there are times when you're designing something, you put on that role. So nobody is any of these. They are accessible to us once we understand. And I wrote an essence statement for each role. So you can look at it like parenting. Since we were talking about your kids just before,
yeah.
Parenting, one aspect of the essence of parenting is to enable self-determination in every child, starting from young, because if we don't, then they submit to peer pressure. If you remind yourself and they say, all right, the role of a regenerative parent is to enable self-determination. And then another aspect of that, which I put more details on in the book, is to encourage, foster essence expression, who they are, because we can get afraid and we can say they're not going to pass the test and I've got to, you know, incentivize them, rather than say, how does this child take tests? How do they prepare? Because it is their essence I want them to have expressed. So I hope that makes it very clear nobody is one of these roles.
So let me ask you a question, because as I was hearing you talk, I was thinking to myself, there are some roles that I think are very net, like the parent role, right? That very naturally fall into certain situations. Others, though, where I think maybe a little advice on how to think about the roles, or how to think about which roles or which roles appropriate, would come in handy. So I'm thinking about a conversation I actually just had last week when I was in Cleveland for work with a healthcare group. And I was talking at the dinner prior to my keynote with one of the members there, and he had said, you know, my biggest struggle is I've got a group of legacy thinkers, you know, who really don't want to change the way they've done it. They've, you know, been in the same job for 20 years. They, you know, they had success in their past, but things have changed, are changing, and they need to change with it. When I think about him, like, what advice do you have for him, and what role makes sense in given the situations he's dealing with?
All right. So first, I never give advice. I'm going to talk about how I would think about it, because I believe advice is like an expert model, and it will shut down his ability to think. So I would probably begin to ask him questions that said, give something like, think of one person that you're worried about, because I've got to get them out of the generic mode of there's some mode these people put them in the category of they've got legacy thinking, right? Yep. So the minute he has got a person, I said, well, what do you think is needed there? And so he can ask himself these questions. What do you think is really needed there? If you think about that unique person, what is it that's core to how they work that's different than other people? So trying to tap in a little bit to having him see the essence and make that person a real live person, because as long as they're a category, they're a legacy problem, yeah, he can't get there. And I'd say, well, all right, now that you see that, and let's say, for example, that person has a tendency to be very artistic in how they work. And they're really struggling with all these changeovers into new kinds of computer work and roles people are supposed to play. And once we've gone that far, we're very likely to have him looking at a real person. And he would ask, what do you think your role is in helping? And at this point, he might say, well, I don't know that I'm inventing. So we just mentioned an entrepreneurial role, right?
Yeah.
I don't know that I'm really creating enough space for that. So, well, how, if you were an entrepreneur, I'd probably say to him at that point, if you were an innovator, what would you do that would serve this person? Or if he went in another direction and said, well, I don't even know how to start, I would say, well, let's just design a process and test it. And after we designed it and play with it, I'd say, oh, okay. So if you were an actual designer of processes that work with this person, how would you work on it? And we would go pull out the essence of designer, which is really about being able to match what it is that's present in a situation with what's needed with a person. So the designer is always trying to bring together these things and design something uniquely for that person. So what you have to do is first drop away all the genericness, and that's not a strange offering you gave, because that's very typical, is that managers will begin to cluster people into some categories of different kinds of problems, and then the people, and we've been taught to do that, high performers, low performers. Until we do that and see unique people, and then maybe we can see a pattern of a few, we can discover, oh, I need to take on being a designer. It could be even as simple as you need to be a spirit resource. It depends on the individual situation. And that's why I say, I don't give advice. I try and educate people through Socratic questioning, through the introduction of frameworks like in this book, and then be a thinking partner with them.
You know, it's interesting. I call it the they syndrome. You know, they don't get it. They think this, they think that. And what I find when I go into organizations that I hear a lot of they is what that really tells me is there's a lack of accountability, number one, individual accountability, and oftentimes a lack of recognition of the uniqueness and diversity of the other people in the room that they work with, because it's they. And I'm always fascinated by that when I hear that. And I interviewed a commander from a nuclear submarine ship. And he was saying that one of the things that he did, the first things he did when he came aboard this ship that had a really toxic culture, was that he eliminated the word they. So if you came to him and you said, we have a problem, they didn't get me the parts on time, he'd stop you, and they'd have to reframe it to, I don't have the parts on time because you fill in the blank. And he said just getting rid of the word they helped change their culture. I thought it was an interesting, like just that one word has such a big impact.
It does, because it genericizes and loses individuality, loses the reality of what's going on.
Yeah.
I think a couple of other things, I don't know his particular situation, but when I hear that, when I hear they, I also know that they have, in addition to the culture that needs to be transformed, is they very likely have designed work in a way that makes it really hard for individual uniqueness contributions to rise.
Right.
And in my third book, which I also did with Hachette, The Regenerative Business, I isolated 30 toxic practices, which are designed into work. One of them is feedback, incentives, rewards. I mean, tons of them. But one of the major ones is they design things that everybody's supposed to achieve. And the performance reviews are all driven by you trying to achieve in something that is considered required from everyone. And without the ability of people to have initiative and show agency and figure out where they want to contribute to a strategy. It's not like, you know, inmates running the asylum. We don't get to do that. But if we don't design work, and right now people don't know how to design work, and I've done a couple hundred companies redesigning their work system so that initiative can rise, and then innovation starts to show up because work now supports it. The way I'm measured, the way I'm paid, everything shifts because I no longer have outsiders telling me how to behave. I do love the they, though. I hate the they because I think that is a really good example of the undermining of individuality.
All right. So before we have to close out, where can people go to learn more and connect?
CarolSanford.com. Has leads to all my business communities, which are at CarolSanfordInstitute.com, all of my change agent communities, and I have programs for women, women business leaders working together, and that's on seed-communities.com, but you can get there off of CarolSanford.com. You can find, I run three podcasts, but the one that's most intriguing, and you can find it also on CarolSanford.com, is Business Second Opinion. You can tell all day, you give me an idea and I'll give you a second opinion. So I take Harvard Business Review, I critique it one article and one idea at a time, tear it to shreds in terms of the paradigm it came from, how much of John Watson is there, and I give an alternative. My email, if anyone actually wants to send me a note directly, is carol@carolsanford.com. It's all about me.
So Carol, since it's all about you, what's your final words for innovators, all of us on Launch Street?
That's a really good question. I think that for me, it is switching the paradigm from the expert, advisor, judger, external, whatever it is, to one where we lift up people who individually are now in community, in context, contributing. And we build an epistemology. That's how we're allowed to know and learn, right? We build that so that people don't accept or reject things from outside without testing it personally. And that's what I wrote The Regenerative Life about, was how it is you can take on roles and you can test them. And therefore, you can use that even when you read someone's book or article or listen to their podcast, you can listen not with a skeptical mind, but with a critical thinking mind of your own.
You know, on that note, one of my favorite things to do, particularly with my kiddos, when we watch the news in particular, is, you know, after we watch a piece on whatever, or even read an article in a paper, I always like to ask them, well, why do you think they wrote that? Well, why do you think they would feel that way? Well, what do you think someone on the other side would think of that piece? And what would their argument be? Because I want them, and I want myself to keep, I love what you said about testing it personally. I think without even realizing it until you said that, a big believer in that, because I think the critical thinking piece is the part that I want them to take away from it, not what the media has decided you should know about the piece. Because, you know, I try to break down the language too. Like, even if you watch something that you think seems in the middle, but they'll use language that drives you one way or the other. So it's fascinating to me, though, to, like, I think the news is a great place to start for all of us on Launch Street, of just, if you want to really test that piece of testing it for yourselves, as Carol's talking about, is just take the news and break it down and ask questions about why and how it's positioned. And I think we'll all find a lot of layers underneath that.
Boy, do I agree with that. What's the source and why?
Thank you
for doing that.
So, Carol, thanks for stopping by. This has been fantastic. I appreciate all the not advice, because that's not what it is.
You're welcome. Thanks for inviting me.
Thanks for hanging with us on Inside Launch Street. If you know someone that is truly ready to unlock their innovation advantage, have them join you on Launch Street. Discover your innovation advantage. Build a team of high-performing innovators and ignite ideas and solutions that create massive impact. GOTO, LaunchStreet.com. Remember, innovators, if you don't take the leap, somebody else will.